warm welcome here. And Lars, thank you for your generous introduction. Please forgive me for speaking in English. I know you all understand English extremely well, but I nevertheless wish that I could speak in Norwegian. It is wonderful to be back here, and I want to thank you all for coming. I want to acknowledge Ambassador Barry Quiet and his wife Eleanor. Thank you both for being here. I should start by congratulating the Norwegian people on the spectacular performance in the Olympics in Canada. And someone will have to explain to me how a nation of 4.5 million people can get more gold medals than a nation of 300 million. But as they say, practice. Anyway, it was a great achievement for Norway, and I do sincerely congratulate you. I am very happy to be here on the occasion of the publication of Our Choice, a plan to solve the climate crisis, and I want to talk a little bit about that today, and also talk a little bit about the recent developments and climate debate worldwide, and in the aftermath of the Copenhagen conference, for which we all had great expectations earlier in the year, and the recent attacks on the climate science and climate scientists, and what the implications of these developments are. First of all, I wish that the recent attacks on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change meant that we no longer faced a massive climate crisis and no longer had the need to organize large-scale preventive and adaptation measures as a result. It would lift quite a burden from all of us not to have to worry that future generations might one day look back on the present generation as a criminal generation that had selfishly and blithely ignored clear warnings that their fate was in our hands. If it were an illusion, if it were not to exist, we would still have to take action to reduce our dependence on carbon-based fuels, because the world is going to run out of them. The production rate is declining, and the rate of new discoveries is declining. And though more oil fields will surely be discovered, nevertheless, the demand for oil in China and India and other fast-growing emerging economies is shifting the balance between supply and demand and making the world economy ever more vulnerable to disruptions in the supply, especially since that market is dominated by the very large reserves owned by sovereign states in the Persian Gulf region, which is arguably the one region in the world that is most vulnerable to disruption, political change, violence, and other factors. Indeed, we have already seen on several occasions in the last 35 years the use of that oil supply as a political tool. And in the future, we will be even more vulnerable to manipulation and disruption in those oil supplies. We would also, if the climate crisis were an illusion, we would also still face the need to create millions of good new jobs in a global effort to promote sustainable growth in the economy. And we are fortunate to have the task ahead of us of shifting to renewable sources energy, much higher levels of efficiency, sustainable agriculture, and sustainable forestry as nevertheless, if these recent attacks had indeed demonstrated that the science doesn't say what the scientists have told us it says, we would all feel a sense of relief. Unfortunately, that's not the case, because we are still putting 90 million tons of global warming pollution every day into the atmosphere as if it's an open sewer. And the fundamental relationship between humanity and the ecosphere of our planet has still been radically transformed, because in less than 100 years we have seen a quadrupling of human population. And even though it is stabilizing and family sizes are declining all over the world, nevertheless, our collective impact on the Earth's environment is far larger now than it has ever been in history. And not only because of our much larger numbers, but also because our technologies have led us to this heavy dependence on carbon-based fuels. And the individual impact that each person on average is having on the Earth has been magnified manyfold by the enhanced power of the technologies that are now in routine use. Several years ago, with An Inconvenient Truth, I sought to portray the nature of the crisis, its causes, and its impacts. And in the last section of that book, I talked about the solutions in a broad overview. But in our choice, the focus is almost entirely on the solutions that are now available, with an enumeration of each solution and an analysis of how useful these solutions are, how practical they are, and how ready for use they are, and what changes in policy and law are necessary in order to accelerate the transition to a low-carbon economy. In the writing of this book, I conducted more than 30 so-called solution summits with the leading experts from all around the world in each of the technologies and in each of the policy areas that need to be a part of a comprehensive plan to solve the climate crisis. And the overall conclusion was one that caused me to be very optimistic, because it's obvious from this three-year work that the solutions are available. We have them. We can do this. But it does require a commitment. And that commitment, in turn, requires sufficient political will expressed by publics in the form of encouragement and pressure on political leaders in every nation to make the changes that are necessary. The solutions really do require policy changes. It is important for each of us as individuals to change the light bulbs and the windows, but it's much more important to change the laws and the policies. Because only when the rules of the road reflect the reality of the true cost this global warming pollution poses to us will we be able to routinely make intelligent and wise decisions about the future of human civilization. That political will has been attacked in the recent effort to undermine the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And to say a brief word about that, for 22 years, the IPCC has prepared thousands of pages of careful scientific analysis. Four comprehensive assessments have been released. And in the last assessment, 3,000 pages long, the critics have now found two mistakes, at least two, maybe there are more, but two that have come to notice. One involved the transposition of numbers that reflect the melting rate for the glaciers in the Himalayas that are covered by debris, and that mistake was not caught during the review process. The second mistake involved information provided to the IPCC by the Dutch government about topographical maps of the Netherlands, and that information was later found to be partially incorrect. So these two mistakes, and any others that may be found, should be placed in perspective. Science is never going to be 100% free of error because it's a human enterprise. Nevertheless, the scientific community, both in the IPCC and in the National Academies of Science around the world and in the professional scientific societies, have undertaken an effort to examine and improve their procedures to make certain that they can minimize the chance of any mistakes in the future. But the impact of these two mistakes has been magnified out of all proportion because the critics have been provided a very large megaphone, in effect, partially financed by large carbon polluters and ideological opponents of government action in any realm, in order to pursue a determined strategy of trying to create doubt in the minds of publics about how real this crisis is. Because we react automatically to threats that our ancestors survived, and because we are hardwired to respond to snakes and spiders and claws and fires, we are better at reacting to those kinds of dangers. When there is a much larger danger that requires us to use our reasoning capacity and to communicate among ourselves in order to hold in our minds a clear picture of the reality we're facing, that is a more difficult process. It is not automatic, it is not reflexive, it's not visceral. It requires an active will to dig into the science, to look at the facts, to share it with others, to test it by discourse and analysis, and then to reach a conclusion that can be used as the basis of action. One of the chapters in this book, towards the last section of the book, is an analysis of what the neuroscientists and behavioral psychologists and experts on the human brain and human nature have learned about the way we think about climate and the climate crisis. It's one of my favorite chapters because I learned so much from spending a lot of time with these experts. I'll use that as an example, by the way, of the so-called Solution Summit. I had two full days with the leading neuroscientists and behavioral psychologists who have specialized in this field. And the first thing I learned is that you have to keep those two groups separate from one another. And they are completely different disciplines and they have completely different approaches, but they both reach the same set of conclusions, and I just summarized some of them for you. But in addition, they point out that because the impacts of the climate crisis are distributed globally, it masquerades as an abstraction. And because the length of time that passes between the causes and the consequences stretches out over a longer period than we're used to holding in mind continuously, it gives us the illusion that we have the luxury of time in forming a response to this crisis. But the scientists who specialize in climate and the related fields warn us that one characteristic of this crisis is that the Earth system has built-in lags or delays. For example, the majority of the heat that is trapped in the atmosphere by global warming pollution is stored in the oceans, which cover the majority of the planet, and it is only re-released into the atmosphere over time. Now, that's an important fact, because what it means is that we can, without being fully aware of it, cross a threshold beyond which the catastrophic consequences become inevitable before the manifestations of those consequences is readily visible and apparent. And so the need to rely on what the science is telling us about this looming catastrophe is even greater because of those lag times. Nevertheless, the challenge to our thinking and to our ways of communicating with one another and to the process by which we form political will to act is made more difficult because of these lag times. Also, because, as I mentioned, the impacts are distributed globally, the transient weather phenomena in any particular location or region can obscure what is happening on the globe as a whole. This winter, for example, in Northern Europe and in much of the United States has been perceived as a very, very cold winter. But on a global basis, it has not been at all. January was the second hottest January since modern temperature records have been kept globally. Now, that only goes back 130 years, but nevertheless, it is an indication of the fact that what seems to be cold in one place is actually a climate that is steadily warming worldwide. There's an old saying in the U.S., I'm sure you have it in Norway as well, don't miss the forest for the trees. Do you have that saying? Well, in the same way, don't miss the climate for the snowstorm. A single manifestation can obscure the entirety of what's going on with the climate. And after all, large regions of the world are already manifesting the impact of the climate crisis. I had the privilege of working with your foreign minister, John Stewart, in co-chairing the Melting Ice Report, which looked at the entire cryosphere, the frozen areas of the planet. And it's so obvious when you look around the world and see that virtually every ice-covered location is melting. And the Arctic ice cap, which for most of the last 3 million years has been the size of the continental United States, is now disappearing rapidly. How would the skeptics explain the fact that after 3 million years, suddenly 40% of the North Polar ice cap is gone, and the rest of it is expected to disappear in, who knows, a decade? Some say less than that. Some say 2 decades. But in the context of millions of years, the difference between 10 years and 20 years is trivial. Indeed, these are changes that are occurring. Massive fires all around the planet now, in the American West, in Siberia, in Africa, South America, perhaps most prominently of all in Australia. I went to an event in Australia a few months ago to launch a new environmental group there. And without my knowledge, and had decided something was very different about those fires. And so they dug into what the experts had to teach them about it, and they announced that day that they have been first responders to fire, and their leader said, from now on, we are first responders to global warming. And they just completed a relay race across most of Australia to try to raise public awareness of the seriousness of this crisis. So people all over the world are getting the message, are understanding what the scientists are saying, but the formation of political will has been slowed down. And in Copenhagen, early last year, we had hoped for a real breakthrough there, and China had privately signaled through back channels to the United States that if the United States passed legislation mandating reductions in global warming pollution emissions below the 1990 levels, then China would join in serious efforts to get a meaningful treaty. But then the U.S. Senate failed to act, even though the House of Representatives has passed such a measure, and that forced President Obama to go to Copenhagen without a law in hand. And given the world's experience in waiting for the United States to join the Kyoto Treaty in the decade before, it meant that President Obama did not have the bargaining power that he needed. China balked, and with both of the two largest global warming polluters refusing to take action, the world community was effectively paralyzed. And so the conference ended with a statement that most joined into taking note of an intention to act. This was hailed as progress, and I suppose if you're strained, you can see it as progress, but I felt that it fell far short of even the minimum necessary to build the kind of momentum that we need in order to discharge our responsibility to our children and grandchildren and those who will come after them. In any case, I wrote this book in order to put in one place all of the latest and best information about how to solve the climate crisis. And so it necessarily is a comprehensive look, but it is written for a general audience, and as those of you who picked it up can see, it is filled with pictures and graphics and illustrations that make it very easy to absorb the material. And by the way, my wife and I are giving 100% of the profits from this book that we would otherwise receive to the Alliance for Climate Protection, which is a nonprofit foundation that has the mission of raising public awareness and urgency about this crisis. The book begins with an introduction that sets the stage and describes the challenge. And then it shifts to a discussion of exactly what the problem is in its simplest form. There are six molecules, six kinds of global warming pollution. And you've heard the old saying, what goes up must come down. Well, that works to our advantage in solving global warming, because in the simplest way to express the solution, we have to reduce the pollution that goes up, and we have to accelerate the amount that comes down. And there are ways to reduce what goes up, and there are ways to accelerate what comes back out of the atmosphere. But in essence, these pollutants can go up very quickly, particularly if we burn all the coal and oil. But the natural process by which they come back out of the atmosphere can take a great deal of time. But we can accelerate it in ways that are outlined in the book. If you rank the six causes of global warming, and I won't go through all of them, but carbon dioxide is the largest by far, and causes more than 40% of the problem. The next the biggest cause is methane, the principal component of natural gas. It's also contained in large underground repositories in the frozen tundra of the Arctic, and one of the reasons, parenthetically, one of the reasons the scientists warn us that we don't have the luxury of time is that if temperatures continue to increase to the point where the thawing of the Arctic tundra releases large quantities of methane and CO2, we could double the amount in the atmosphere in a relatively short period and make an already difficult problem twice as hard to solve. So methane is a significant source. Black carbon or soot is now believed to be the third largest source, and that's from incomplete combustion, and it's produced in the burning of forests, burning of any kind of agricultural waste, except cow dung, which is burned for cooking in the subcontinent and in some other places, charcoal, wood, and this has a double effect. It traps heat in the atmosphere, but it also covers the surface of the ice and makes it less reflective, thereby accelerating the melting rate. In any case, I won't go into all of them because I'm giving you a brief overview, but these are the six global warming pollutants that have to be addressed, not just CO2. Often in discussions of global warming, the entire focus is on CO2, and I have made many presentations where most all of the focus is on CO2. And I think that's justifiable, because if we get a grip on the largest root cause, then the same policies and procedures that work there can be applied to the others as well. And it is, after all, by far the largest and the fastest growing. But a truly comprehensive solution to global warming must also address the other five global warming pollutants, especially methane and black carbon. The next part of the book goes into the energy system that we are using in the world today, because a very large percentage of the global warming pollutants result from our current way of using energy. The first oil well was discovered 150 years ago, drilled in Pennsylvania in my country. And in the same year, the great Irish scientist John Tyndall first discovered that CO2 molecules trap infrared radiation, or heat. So the birth of modern climate science and the beginning of the oil age date back to exactly the same year. But even when oil was first, even when the first oil well was drilled, we had already been using a large amount of coal around the world. It was the principal fuel that drove the Industrial Revolution, particularly the Second Industrial Revolution. And even though oil is now the largest source of energy in the world, coal is second, and coal produces much more CO2 for each unit of energy than does oil. And all of this is laid out in the chapter on energy. So part of the strategic plan to solve global warming obviously includes paying careful attention to the reshaping of the world's energy systems to shift toward renewables, toward low-carbon sources, toward the capturing of CO2 where that's possible. And the energy system is therefore given very prominent attention. Then the next section of the book goes into the renewable sources of energy one by one. Solar energy is particularly prominent in the far northern latitudes. It is a different kind of option than it is where sunlight is more abundant throughout the year. But the new transmission grids and smart grids make it possible to share renewable energy chapter in this book about smart grids, new transmission technologies, new energy storage options that are being rapidly perfected, all of which will expand the usefulness of solar and wind and other renewable sources. But solar energy is particularly important for one simple reason. More solar energy falls on the surface of the Earth in 1 hour than is necessary to provide all of the energy the world needs for a full year. So improvements in the efficiency with which that sunlight can be converted into electricity and heat are very, very important. And in examining the usefulness of these technologies, we have to factor in the impact of our own decisions to make a commitment to use more solar energy. Here's the point I'm trying to make here. The businesses that develop solar panels will put more or less research and development funding into the improvements of that technology, depending upon how large a market they are going to be competing in. If the world woke up tomorrow morning with the certain knowledge that governments across this planet had made an all-out commitment to depend much more heavily on solar energy, then companies around the world would fall all over themselves competing to spend money reducing the cost and improving the technology. As an analogy, think of what happened in the computer chip industry. You've heard of Moore's Law. Moore's Law, named after an engineer named Gordon Moore, who first noticed back many a half century ago that the number of transistors that could be put on a computer chip was doubling every 18 to 24 months, which translates into the practical reality that we all live with now enjoyably, and that is that the price of information processing, the price of a computer, the price of a smartphone, comes down steadily, even as the quality and effectiveness goes up. It's a happy development. Well, Moore's Law is not a law of physics. It's a law of mutually fulfilling expectations, because the computer chip companies saw that the market for computer chips was growing rapidly. Incidentally, this year, for the first time, we'll see 1 billion transistors for every man, woman, and child on the Earth. That's astonishing. Of course, there's so many transistors in the typical smartphone that you can see how the calculation mounts up. But my point is, when they saw this market growing so rapidly, they looked over their shoulders at the competition, and they decided to commit enormous sums of money to R&D to make certain that they would be able to double the amount of transistors on a chip every 2 years. And since they all did it, the industry began to follow that development pathway. Again, to complete the analogy, if our world made a commitment to shift to renewable energy, you would see cost reduction curves already apparent for solar panels begin to accelerate so that the cost would come down quite significantly. It's already happening to some degree, but it would happen much more dramatically with a much larger scale commitment. Now, there are several different kinds of solar energy. I won't dwell on them, and most of you know this, but the concentrating solar thermal power, that's the kind that uses mirrors to concentrate the sun's rays to boil water, to make steam and turn a turbine, or they heat some other liquid that then's used to boil water. And this is a very effective technology, especially in areas where there's abundant sunlight, the southwestern U.S., Europe, the desert areas of western India, western China, Australia. It's a very important source of solar energy. And then the other kind, called photovoltaics, of course, is the kind that translates the photons in the sunlight directly into electrons, making an electrical current. And that's the one where technology and scientific advances probably has a lot more leverage to bring that cost down dramatically. That's where we're seeing the dramatic progress. Then there's passive solar energy and solar hot water heaters and the like, and they're all important. The next chapter is on wind. Wind energy is very well known by now, and in my country, for each of the last 3 years, the largest new source of electricity has come from wind. And now with the development of offshore wind farms, we're seeing further progress. Denmark, as everyone knows, is the world's leader in terms of the percentage of the wind that they, the percentage of their electricity that they get from wind. And we're seeing a real surge in wind power throughout the world. Now, with both solar and wind, we in the United States, you in Norway, those of us in Western democracies should ask, why is China making an all-out commitment to be the number one developer and manufacturer of both wind and solar? It's because they see the opportunity in the marketplace in this 21st century. And they understand that it's going to create employment opportunities, it's going to be a source of foreign exchange and national income. And so while we're debating in the West, we should look over our shoulders at what at least one source of competition is doing. The third source that I explore is something called enhanced geothermal power. And geothermal power is widely misunderstood and identified with those locations on the surface of the earth where hot water bubbles up from the interior. And in some of those locations, they have long since produced electricity. But the much larger resource is deeper in the earth, a few kilometers down, almost everywhere on the planet. There is such a large amount of heat coming from the interior of the earth, which is many thousands of degrees, and from the natural decay of radioactive elements, not only uranium, but potassium, and some we don't think about as radioactive, that generate heat in the crust of the earth and in the mantle of the earth. And if you dig down, dig a hole in the ground, it'll feel, on a hot day it'll feel cool, because a few meters down, the average temperature is the yearly average of the atmospheric temperature in that region. But then if you dig deeper, it gets warmer. And if you dig down far enough, a kilometer or so, it's very hot. And there are new technologies to circulate water through those hot regions, use it to make steam, and again, turn turbines and generate electricity. The limiting factor has been the technology of the drill bits, because when it gets so hot, the drill bits have to be very tough. But they have improved this technology. And in the United States alone, we're estimated to have a 30,000-year supply of energy just from enhanced geothermal power. In Europe and Asia, on every continent, the same resources available. Rich countries, poor countries, doesn't matter. So this has a fantastic potential, and in my view, should be developed very rapidly. Now, the next source that I talk about is biomass, and this is a controversial source. Many of these are controversial, because in the case of biomass, the first generation of ethanol made from starches like corn has been something of a disappointment. The because the energy conversion has not always been positive. The amount of fertilizer that's petroleum-based, natural gas-based, used to grow the corn means that over the lifetime of that product, there are very little savings in CO2. Sometimes it's even negative. And if it competes with food crops, then it can drive food prices up. Probably been blamed for too much of food price increase over the last couple of years, but it does have an effect. So it needs to be evaluated carefully. Luckily, as this chapter points out, the second generation of biofuels and the third generation of biofuels, that latter including algae, offer tremendous promise, because the so-called cellulosic ethanol processes, just meaning made not from starches like corn or from cane sugar, but from the wheatier plants with more cellulose and lignin in the plant material, the conversion into usable energy can be much higher, and it does not compete with food crops. And this is another area where science and technology give tremendous leverage in driving the cost down. So it's not without troubles, not without controversy, but I think it's going to be one of the components of a solution. Now let me briefly cover two of the solutions that have been proposed that are in the controversial category: carbon capture and storage, and nuclear power. And I'll do this briefly, but carbon capture and storage sounds like it might be a magic answer. We can keep burning coal if we can just trap all that CO2 before it goes into the atmosphere, and then compress it into a liquid or quasi-liquid state, bury it deep in the ground where it's safe and we can forget about it. If we could do that economically, that would be a wonderful thing. And Norway has led the world with the Sleipner Field and the North Sea. I have a picture of that in this chapter. And I think that CCS, as it's called, carbon capture and storage, will play a role. But I came away from my research on this technology feeling that its usefulness is likely to be limited because of the enormous cost, both in money and in energy, especially when you try to use it for coal-burning plants. Because coal-burning electricity plants produce such a very high volume of CO2, it takes an enormous amount of energy to trap it and compress it and store it. If you run a coal-burning electric utility, you're in the business of selling electricity. If you put carbon capture and storage on your plant, you will have to pay roughly one-third of all the electricity you're now selling and use it to run your carbon capture and storage project. And so your business plan will suffer, because if you have to take one-third of what you're selling and no longer sell it, that's going to cause a big dent in the profitability of these companies. And since there's a public benefit, why not socialize that cost? Well, here's the problem there. The public's appetite for paying that cost may have limits when they look at the volume of CO2 that has to be captured, stored, compressed, and all the rest. Just an enormously expensive process. And the places where it is stored underground have to be chosen very carefully and studied carefully. The good news is it can be done. The good news further is that it's almost certainly safe. Because unlike nuclear waste or some chemical waste, CO2, the longer it is stored underground, the safer it gets. because it begins to seep into the rocks in which it's stored, and it becomes more stable the longer it's down there. But every single storage repository has to be exhaustively investigated to make sure, for example, there's not some abandoned well that provides a chimney back up to the surface, because it'll come back up if it's not securely built. And that can pose risk to people in the region, although their techniques for characterizing these sites are so good now that I personally would feel confident living near one or on top of one. But the amount of time and effort and money required to make sure that each of these sites is appropriate is another cost that goes with this carbon capture and storage technology. Ultimately, I believe that the world will decide that it is more economical to speed up the shift to renewable energy and stop burning so much coal, and cheaper than trying to capture and store all of that CO2. But my opinion, after a lot of study, the opinions of the scientists who spent so many decades on this, that's one thing. The real answer would be an answer that comes in the marketplace when and if we put a price on CO2. Because now we're making flawed choices routinely because we don't take the impact of global warming pollution into account. So this chapter is one of the many places in the book that anticipates the economics chapter, which lays out why it's so important for the price tag on CO2. Now let me cover the nuclear chapter just briefly. There's a lot of interest in this. And here is another technology that's often seen as possibly a magic solution. Of course, we know there are problems storing nuclear waste, and there have been some accidents at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and so forth. But I believe that those problems, nuclear waste storage and the safety of reactor operation, I believe those problems can be solved. But there are two other problems that I came away from this analysis believing are going to be more difficult to solve. The first is the cost of nuclear power. It's been increasing 15% a year for more than 30 years. And a reactor that used to cost $400 million U.S. now costs $4 to $6 billion U.S. And, by the way, if you run a utility and you order a new, you're thinking about building a new reactor or ordering a new reactor, you've got a budget to deal with, you've got to project how much electricity you're going to be selling 10, 15 years from now. You've got a lot of difficult choices. And so you're trying to make the decision, should I build this new reactor? What effect does it have on you when you bring in the engineers and you ask them, okay, what's your estimate of how long it will take to build this reactor? When their answer is, we have no idea. What if you ask, what will the final cost be when this reactor is completed? And their answer is, sorry, have no idea. That's the reality that utilities are facing. There is not a single reputable engineering firm in Europe or North America that will stand behind an estimate of how long it will take to complete a reactor or how much it will cost when it's finished. No wonder utilities are reluctant to make these commitments. Now, the design of the current generation of reactors is somewhat flawed. They scaled up the design. They now only come in one size, extra large. So you have to make a huge commitment in the face of all that uncertainty. Nevertheless, I think that some new reactors will be built. And I think that nuclear power will play a somewhat larger role than it does now. I don't think it's cost competitive, but if we had a price on carbon, we would get a better answer to that question too. But the good news is, and not everyone shares my optimism, but the good news for me is that there are new designs for smaller safer reactors that will be available 15, 20, 25 years from now that may open up a brighter future for nuclear power to play a larger role. But we're a long ways from that. It takes time to build the demonstration and pilot projects and test the technologies. But eventually, I think that it will play a larger role. Sometimes I hear people say, wouldn't it be great if the scientists could invent a new technology that would pull CO2 back out of the air, just scavenge it from the atmosphere. Wouldn't that be great? Well, we have such a technology. It's called a tree. And when you take that technology to scale, it's called a forest. And in the chapter on forests, there's a full exploration of what needs to be done in order to protect the forests of the earth and enhance their ability to pull CO2 back out of the atmosphere. Unfortunately, as you know, our current approach to forests around the world includes burning them down and destroying them in a very harmful way. And the largest deforesters in the world are Brazil, Indonesia, Sudan, some other countries in Central Africa, Southeast Asia, and South America. There are a lot of countries that are following these policies and need to change, but that's where it's concentrated. And part of what was hoped for in Copenhagen was the linkage of industrial emissions reductions with the protection of forests. In any case, better forestry is a key part of the solution. We need to plant billions of trees. China, incidentally, in each of the last 3 years has planted 2.5 times more trees than the entire rest of the world put together. It's one of the hopeful signs in China's policy. But the next chapter was another one that was a tremendous learning experience for me, and it has to do with soils. When I was a young boy growing up in the summers on my family's farm in Tennessee, I learned from my father how to recognize the richest, best-growing soil. And those of you who spent time on a farm can probably recognize it. It looks black and moist. Why is it black? That's the carbon. 58% of the key growing layer is pure organic carbon. And actually, there are between 3 and 4.5 times as much carbon in the topsoil of the world as in all the forests put together. And yet modern industrial agriculture and factory farming pulls the carbon out of the soil in very large quantities. The good news laid out in this chapter is that better sustainable agricultural techniques can restore the carbon content of the soil while increasing the productivity of farmers and making their farms more sustainable. And there are lots of new approaches. Biochar is talked about in here, mycorrhizal fungi, and the specialized fungi and bacteria involved are very important. In any case, sustainable agriculture and forestry are really an important part of this. Now, moving toward the conclusions, the most important and largest source of new energy and reductions in CO2 is one that we tend not to think about as a category. It's efficiency. And with new computers and new computer controlled tools, we now can create an infrastructure, buildings, transportation systems, a built environment that is far more efficient. Because so much of our industrial enterprise grew up in an era of cheap energy, it is by and large filled with legacy systems that are horribly wasteful and inefficient. And that creates tremendous opportunity. The internal combustion engine, as an example, uses only 10% of the petrol in the gas tank to move the car from point A to point B. And if you analyze how much of that energy is used to move the person inside the car from point A to point B, it is 0.6%, less than 1%. So 99% is wasted when you look at the purpose for which we think we're using it. Similarly, 30 to 40% of the CO2 emissions worldwide come from inefficient buildings. Now, here in Norway, in your environment, with your ethics, you've always built very efficiently. And in Scandinavia, the building standards have been upgraded further still and are now very, very efficient. But in much of the world, the amount of CO2 emissions from very inefficient buildings does represent an enormous opportunity. And again, that creates jobs in retrofitting and making those structures efficient. Efficiency in electric motors and pumps and piping systems, it's a good long list. But in general, again, if we put a price on carbon, that will drive through the global economy the appropriate allocation of resources and attention devoted to becoming much more efficient. So if we can solve the climate crisis, help solve the climate crisis while making money and creating jobs, that ought to be an easy choice. But it requires paying attention to the economic policies that give us signals about the consequences of the choices we make. And the economics chapter has much more than why a price on carbon is needed, but for purposes of this overview, I'll focus on that. CO2 is invisible, tasteless, and odorless, and it has no price tag. So the old saying, out of sight, out of mind, applies with extra force to CO2. If we included the value of CO2 in our economic calculations, it would change everything. And that's why if we're going to use the market system as one of the principal ways that we guide our path and that we make choices in the world, we ought to make sure that it's as accurate as we can make it. And if we just exclude important material factors from any of the accounting, then of course we're going to make flawed choices. But, again, those industries and companies whose business plans require them to depend on unrestrained access to the atmospheric commons as a dumping ground for their pollution will naturally and do naturally resist any effort to include the value of that pollution in our economic calculations. But the rest of us really should push hard to remedy that flaw in the way we make these market calculations. And we have to do so within the political system. The politics chapter focuses a good bit on the U.S., but also globally. And, you know, we have a philosophy in the world that is now dominant, and I'm glad it is, market democracy, or democratic capitalism. It's a compound philosophy. Free markets, free politics. And those spheres, the democracy sphere and the market sphere, overlap. And in Scandinavia and in most of Western Europe, the democracy sphere has a little bit more of the total. In the U.S., the market sphere has a little bit more. And after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism, in the United States, that produced a bubble of market fundamentalism and a hubristic effort to try to move the market sphere into a more dominant position to take away some of the decisions that had been made in the democracy sphere. So the resistance to any kind of constraint on exploitative behavior in the marketplace grew even stronger. And it was right at that time that scientists confirmed that the evidence on global warming showed conclusively that earlier years had been greatly understated. And so this whole debate took form at a moment when in the West, and particularly in the United States, the ability to use the democratic sphere as a source of regulations and constraints on global warming pollution was under attack. But we have to work within the political process to change that, and that's what this chapter outlines. And I already referred to the thinking chapter, and there's more, the use of new information technologies to help solve the crisis, and then a conclusion. Which brings me to my own conclusion here. As I stated at the outset, I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to come back to Norway again. I was in Tromsø several months ago, and of course will always, throughout my life, remember the special days here at Oslo a few years ago. I'm especially grateful for your willingness to come and hear this presentation of my book. I look forward to signing some copies, and I will just close by saying, as I have on occasions past, that we do have everything we need to solve the climate crisis, with the possible exception of political will. But political will really is a renewable resource. Thank you very much.